All right, as you see from the timeline, Esther comes in about, 60 years from the time that that the children of Israel came back from Babylonian captivity. And I was going to go into Nehemiah, but I noticed that she came first, so I thought I'd go ahead and keep it in chronological order. And I was really surprised as I went through the introduction at how much trouble Esther has in the religious world. A lot of people don't think that that book belongs in the scriptures. And I wanted to read you what Martin Luther wrote, that first quote there under introduction. "I am so great an enemy to the second book of the Maccabees and to Esther that I wish they had not come to us at all. For they have too many heathen unnaturalities. The Jews much more esteemed the book of Esther than any of the prophets, though they were forbidden to read it before they had attained the age of 30 by reason of the mystic matters it contains." Now, I have no idea where he got any of that, but it just kind of encapsulates from about 100 on, it's been about 50-50 as to whether or not Esther even belongs in the Old Testament scriptures. And what they base it on is two things, primarily. One is, how many times is God mentioned in Esther?
None.
Okay, he's never mentioned. No scriptures are... Oh, Ray? Did you have your hand up? Oh, okay. There are... And it's not found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so since it wasn't found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, this has emboldened some people. But as one writer wisely put it, the Essenes, who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, were way, way stricter than the Pharisees. Matter of fact, Esther would not have fit into their theology at all, so it's not surprising at all that they didn't have anything to do with it. It is in Josephus, which was written a couple hundred years before Christ, but the best argument that I read was, if there was a problem with Esther, why didn't Jesus deal with it? If Esther doesn't belong in the Old Testament, and Esther was in the Bible that he was using, wouldn't he have said, this book doesn't belong in here? So I think we can be pretty comfortable. You know, and I really debated, do I even want to deal with this in the class? But I just want you to be aware that there are a lot of people, even today, I was reading on the internet this morning, all the different points that people are making, and a lot of people today just don't think that Esther belongs in the scriptures at all. I happen to disagree very strongly because I think the message of Esther is, as a matter of fact, we pointed this out a couple weeks ago now. Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther are three books in which God's providence is coming through all the time and there's no miracles. So they actually have, we can have more affinity to Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther as Bible characters because we don't see any real overt movements by God to get involved, and yet you can see his hand all the way through. And this, of course, is what we pray for in 2 Timothy 2. In a great house there are what? Vessel for honor and vessel for dishonor. And if you want to be meat for the master's use, what do you need to do? But if you explore that concept of meat for the master's use, what exactly does that mean? How can you be meat for the master to use? Virgin?
You become prepared.
Okay. And if a job comes up, what happens?
You're ready.
You're ready, and who puts you in line?
God.
Well, if we're meat for the master's use, then the master is going to use us. And that's what we call providence. We see it with the Ethiopian eunuch. How did Philip happen to get to that road? Well, it was all orchestrated by God. Now, in that particular case, the Holy Spirit was actively involved, but even if he hadn't have been, would it have been any different? The Spirit hadn't done the last thing, which was, go join yourself to that chariot. Do we need the Holy Spirit to tell us to go join ourselves if we see an opportunity? All right, Brian?
Yeah, and in addition to the providence, I mean, you see the courage of Haman, and I mean, Mordecai and Esther, and you also see, what might have happened to the Jews had they not shown the courage that they showed and had the decree written and so forth.
Right. It's a definite, and it's one of the last of the historical books. And the more I thought about it today, I think that there's a pretty good parallel between Joseph's life and Esther. Because although Joseph got the dreams first, what happened is his life unfolded. He gets sold into slavery. He gets bought by Potiphar. What does Potiphar do? Well, throws him in prison, right? Throws him in prison. He ends up in prison. He interprets the dreams of two people who promptly one died and the other
forgot him.
And but when it was all said and done, when his brothers and he are talking, and I've got that verse toward the bottom of page one where it says, "Don't be angry with yourselves. You sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." But then the next verse really nails it. It says, verse 20, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." So does the free will activities of the people involved, does God control them? Did God force those people to sell Joseph into slavery? No. No. God uses opportunities that people give him. And if his brothers had not sold him into slavery, you think God might have found another way to get him to Egypt? Yeah. He, no matter what circumstances arise, God can work with it. Carl?
There's a verse in Proverbs that says that a man makes plans, but God controls
it. Right. Yeah. That's right. So what we're going to see in Esther is we're going to see a lot of problems. And I guess that's why maybe some people don't think that that it's inspired. We're going to see a lot of human issues that really aren't what they ought to be. But is that on God? If the king divorces his wife for unscriptural reasons and sets another person in place, is that God's fault? And if Esther is forced to go into the harem, she didn't volunteer, she was forced to go into the harem, and she was then chosen, is that her fault? So all of this is something that I really think we're gonna be wrestling with as we go through it. So any comments or thoughts so far? Okay, then, we come to the historical background at the very bottom, and we get a really tiny glimpse into the inner workings of the courts of Persia. So let's go ahead and turn over to page 2. And I didn't realize this map was going to end up so small. I had to make it small to make it all fit. But this is the Medo-Persian Empire. And it's really tough to even make it out, so I don't know if it's even worth explaining it. But it was a huge mass of area. And for a period of almost, 150 years from the time of Darius the Mede until Alexander the Great, the Medo-Persian Empire was the ruling power, and they had a lot of money. And they had a lot of kings who were very opulent and very, they used their money for their own personal pleasures. And so this man, I thought of it today, you know, when the Dead Sea Scrolls come or when King Tut's tomb comes, where do they put it? Well, they take it to a place where people can come and admire it. Now, that's essentially what he did, except our exhibits usually don't last. Do most of our exhibits last 180 days, half a year? But this one is for half a year, and everybody can come and go, and they can look at the glorious power and majesty of these people. And then, at the end of that 180-day period, he invites all the people who live in the capital city to come to a banquet. And he's got it all set up out in his garden. And some of the things that you read about, it's just a beautiful place, this garden. And it has a, let's just kind of scan through it here. We're under the request of the king, Esther 1, 5 through 8. It says in verse 6, "The white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple, on silver rods, marble pillars. The couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble." Now, would that be pretty impressive? You ever been on a gold couch before? I've had four or five myself. Have you ever been on a gold couch before? No, I haven't been on a gold couch. Can't even imagine what it would look like. But they've got these chairs and couches that are made of gold, and they have these white and blue linen curtains. And of course, if it's in a garden, do we have a lot of beautiful flowers and trees and things along that line? And possibly, if you read Ecclesiastes, he would make ponds and he would make put in trees and gardens and all kinds of beautiful things. And then in the midst of this, we have this pavement of alabaster, turquoise, white and black marble. And then verse 7, they serve drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other. So how many gold cups have we drank out of? And I wonder how they kept all those gold cups from disappearing. But then we run into a slight problem. I guess not a slight problem. Royal wine in abundance. How many of us go to wine tasting places? If that's all they're offering, are we going? See, we're probably not going to go. Although he does say you can drink as much or as little as you want. So there was nothing compulsory about this. And so, but everybody can come and go. And that's the problem here. That's the issue, because after he shows people his glorious riches and the splendor of his excellent majesty, that's Esther chapter 1, verse 4, the very top of the page, then he shows the people the beauty of his garden and of his abilities to create such a beautiful place. And he gets a little merry with wine. Now, does that necessarily mean completely drunken stupor? Or could it mean that he's just pretty happy right now? Now, some people think that for him to make this request of her puts him into a drunken stupor. Because if a man were to ask his beautiful wife to come out and show herself, that would mean he'd have to be drunk. Does that make any sense to you?
Nope.
Would you have to be drunk to do that?
Nope.
But see, here's the problem. Is it wrong for a woman to appear in public? They're telling us that it was wrong for him to ask her and right for her to refuse. Does that make any sense? Do you see anything in the context here that would require that interpretation? We don't know that much about the Medo-Persian Empire. We don't know whether their women wore veils and whether their women were abundantly modest, or whether this was a common occurrence that she just didn't want to give into. And again, I don't know. I'm not going to fault her, but I'm also not going to fault the king. It's just giving us the facts. And it's pretty tough to interpret the facts because we just don't have enough information. However, if she's a humble woman and he's wanting her to come out and flash and show how flashy she is, would that be an issue? Mm-hmm. Would you say? But as I say, this is just the unvarnished truth. He may have been in the wrong. She may have been in the wrong. They may have both been in the wrong. But this is the events as they transpired. George, and then?
Well, if he was married with wine, it's more apt for him to ask her to do that than otherwise, whether or not he was totally drunk or not.
Right.
But he also was the king, and it seems from what history seems to say that most kings expected absolute obedience to whatever came to their mind to ask for.
Right.
And so, in that sense, he was expecting her to come.
And even Esther knew this. You remember what she said when Mordecai said, look, here's what's going to happen. She said, well, he hasn't called me for 30 days, and I think he's upset. And if I go in there, what's going to happen?
If he doesn't raise
that golden scepter,
yeah.
I'm going to be put to death. Now, does that give you some idea of the power of the king and the importance of submission? If a wife just says, I'm going to go see the king, and he just doesn't raise up that scepter, what's going to happen?
Next queen.
Okay. And so all you women, you need to keep that in mind. That when your husband speaks, you should say, how high, right? And that's for the benefit of our newlyweds here. I just wanted to get them off on the right road.
Yeah.
Anyway, and George is right, and but like I say, if you start reading the commentaries, some people say Esther was the sinner and Queen Vashti was really the hero. Is that how the book really proceeds for us? No, and there's just so many assumptions that have to be made. The facts are that the king was merry with wine. He asked his wife to come in to show her beauty, and she said no. Now, that's all we have. Now, you could say, well, I think the wife was in the right and the king was in the wrong. Well, that may or may not be true, but it didn't turn out too well for the wife, did it? Whether she was in the right or the wrong is really not the point. God's just giving us the facts. It's kind of like the book of Job. When you're reading Job's three friends' comments, what does the end of the book say?
They're wrong.
They don't know what they're talking about. You have not spoken to me what is right. And I want you to repent to my servant Job, and he will pray for you. And so, as I say, the Holy Spirit sometimes just gives us the information. And often, he doesn't give us enough information to satisfy our curiosity. Isn't there a lot more we'd like to know here? I kind of wish that the book of Esther was about this big so we could really read all the details, right? Jeff?
What you just described in terms of, you know, here are the facts, here are the facts, man, just the facts, is fairly common in the Bible. It just reports, in many cases, what people did without saying it was right or wrong. And I'm thinking about some of the behavior of, Noah is one example, but Judah and Tamar and many others,
right,
that just, you know, here's the facts, and you walk away going, okay, is God approving that because he included it? Is he disproving it because he included it? Or is it just fact?
Right.
And in a lot of cases, it's just fact.
Which
we don't dismiss Genesis, and we don't dismiss, you know, some of these other books because evil deed, sorry, just because questionable deeds are reported.
Right. So. Right. Okay, so I'm just trying to lay this thing out the way that you're, if you ever do some research on the book, these are some of the things that you're going to run into. And my answer is that Deuteronomy 29:29 says,
secret things
belong to God. Was Vashti right? God doesn't say. Was the king wrong? God doesn't say. I'm not going to say. I'm not going to pass verdicts on situations that we just flat don't have enough information to know what we should do with it. But it does create a dilemma for the people. Because as we've seen in our own culture, when women start to say no, does it just stay in a few homes? I mean, what kind of a culture do we live in today when you start talking about women being in complete submission to their husband? Are them fighting words?
Yes.
So, and that's because of our culture. Now, in Malawi, when I say it, the women are just, yeah, that's right. That's exactly the way it is over here. And they haven't been able to break free of that. And rightfully so, right?
To a degree.
Tim, be careful.
Yeah,
how much submission is a wife to have? Whether she's got a good husband or not, what does the scripture say?
Be in submission.
It says, you be in submission as you are to the Lord. And then it says, as the church is subject to Christ, so let his wife be subject to what?
To her own husband.
To her own husband in everything. And again, I use this a lot in Malawi. The reason I'm saying be careful, Tim, is because you wouldn't believe the heartbreaking stories of how miserably terrible these husbands are to their wives in Malawi. And so can I come in there and say, you wives don't have to be in submission to these men because of what they're asking you to do? Is that the way to preach the truth?
No.
Okay, I saw a hand over here. Jeff?
And everything we've said is true, but there's the other side of the equation, too, with the husband.
Oh, yeah, no.
The wives of themselves, whatever, which what you were starting to bring
but
up.
But the wife can't use the verses for the husband as a hammer, and the husband can't use the verses for the wife as a hammer. Who are the verses to the wife given to?
The wife.
The wife. Now, whether she's got a good husband or a bad husband, and sometimes I just have to, at the very end of the conversation, it's just a miserable situation, and I just ask her, well, who picked this guy for you? And guess what her answer is?
I did.
Well, I'm really sorry, but you're the one who chose this person. And then I look at the rest of the group and I say, now you ladies need to think about this because you don't want to get yourself in this kind of situation. All right, George, and then Carl.
Sometimes people in the church even forget what God said when he created Adam and Eve, that Eve was to be a fitting helper for Adam. And that didn't really change. She's still supposed to be. And he's supposed to love her.
Right.
But people get hung up in one side or the other and don't consider that a loving relationship, people, husband and wife, have to submit to each other.
Exactly.
And to be, as you're always using the term for the love that we should have, if we have that kind of love for our husband or wife, we're not going to be fighting over, do I have to do this or should I have my own way and all of that kind of stuff.
Right. Well, God said in 1 Peter 3 that the meek and quiet spirit is what in the sight of God?
Very precious.
Very precious. So now, some husbands don't deserve that meek and quiet spirit in any way. But if they don't deserve it, so the wife doesn't give it, what does that do to her?
They're both wrong.
Then it makes her, it's a problem. And Jesus dealt with that in Matthew. He said, you turn the other cheek, right? You go the second. What if somebody compels you to go a mile? What are you supposed to do?
Go the second mile.
Go the second mile. So should that be true of women if they have a bad husband? Yeah. Should it be true of husbands if they have a bad wife? Yeah. You have to love your wife whether she deserves it or not, and you have to submit to your husband whether he deserves it or not. And I don't know how in the world we got off on this, but we're going to get off it right now. Go ahead, Carl.
Some years ago, I was exposed to a situation where there was spousal abuse, and I came to the knowledge that there's very much spousal abuse in this country.
Sure.
It is so much that it has moved some states to, if there's a complaint, one of the people in the situation goes to jail automatically. If I'm calling a domestic dispute, one of the people involved must go to jail. This is supposed to be a deterrent. But this is relatively new.
Right.
But it was causing the authorities so much time and expense till they made the ordinance of the law that one person out of that dispute must go to jail because they was having too many people, and the authorities come, oh, don't take him to jail, he's okay, I won't sign the complaint. And that was the result of that law.
Right. All right. Back to Esther here. The queen refused to come. That's the passage here in Esther chapter 1, verse 12. And the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. Pretty typical response. Can we visualize this event occurring? And yeah, this happens all the time. Who's right? Somebody's wrong. Somebody's right. But we don't know. And for the sake of the information in the book, it doesn't matter. But the king doesn't act, and I really appreciate and respect this about him, he doesn't act under his anger. He calls together his wise men who knew law and justice. That's at the very bottom of page 2. So he doesn't just call his buddies together. He said, the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice. And then verse 14, the seven princes of Persia and Media. Then verse 15, what shall we do to Queen Vashti according to law, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs. Now, right or wrong, their problem is she violated the law. And what do you have to do if you violate the law? And what if there was a reason you violated the law? Remember when your kids used to come to you and you'd be punishing one, but he did this and he did this first. What do you say? That you didn't have to respond like that. You should have come and talked to me about it. And so if she had an issue, there were other ways to deal with it than to just absolutely say no in front of not only all the men who heard him ask, Well, what about the women who heard the eunuchs come and say, the king has told you to go? And now they're very concerned. Let me read this next paragraph at the top of page 3. Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so they will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report. King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she did not come. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus, there will be excessive contempt and wrath. Now, you think they're exaggerating here? Or is this going to happen?
It's possible.
Virgil?
Well, if we're the culture that we're looking at, yeah, that would happen.
Okay.
Maybe today in the United States of America, yeah, it wouldn't.
Well, I kind of think it has. And I'm seeing it winding its way into the church also.
Yes, and that's the problem.
And that's the problem. And so from the perspective of these men, this is a serious problem. Now, they've really moved it. Has it been moved out of a personal spat between this man and his wife?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this has nothing to do with a man and his wife. It has to do with a king and a subject. When the king commands and the subject does not respond properly, then that's got to be dealt with. Now, the additional problem here is these royal people, they know their wives. Are there a lot of wives that really aren't happy, but they have to do what their husband says because they're afraid of what would happen if they didn't? And what do these guys know is going to happen if Vashti gets off the hook here? Well, my wife's going to do it too. And so some of these people were deeply concerned, and so they have to deal with this situation. Now, again, whether it's right, whether it's wrong, God doesn't comment on it. He just says, this is how Esther got into the position that she did, right?
It sounds just like today, somebody will get caught, clear cut, evident, they shot their wife, and their mother was, I killed her because I hate her. Whatever it is, they did it, got caught.
Right.
Goes to the judge, and they plea bargain. To get him life of the charity, he probably gets 23 years. And the public's like, how can that be? He didn't get what he deserved.
Right.
And then that's, like you said, that's how it goes on. The next one, they do the same thing. It's like a string of wrong, you know.
Yeah, and we all know that. Ecclesiastes 8:11, right?
Same outcome, you know.
Right. So unless sentence is speedily executed, the hearts of the sons of men are fully set to do evil. So if I'm not happy with, well, let me not use me. Jeannie doesn't like it when I use. If this guy next door to me doesn't like his wife and he sees the guy across the street kills his wife and only gets 6 months in jail, what's he going to start thinking? And is that what's happening? Yeah, all over the country. People, they're just not concerned. There's no... Anyway, so we have to deal with this and... once again, I'm not sure that this was the best solution, but this is what they did. And it's really tough for us. We don't know. How many wives do you think this man had? How many did Solomon have?
Well, if you count concubines, almost 1,000.
300 wives, 600 concubines. So when we're reading here about this woman being deposed, and notice, I don't think divorce is really in this picture. If it pleases, let's read the verse. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him. Let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes so that it cannot be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus. Now, we're going to read the same thing. He's going to bring these women in one at a time. And if he doesn't say anything about her, where does she go?
The harem.
She goes to the harem, but does he call her again?
Nope.
No. Was she divorced? No, she's just ignored in the harem. And so this is the situation here. It's not a divorce, and I'm not sure she was his only wife, but she was his favored wife. When Esther comes in, is she his only wife?
No.
We don't know. We know there's a harem, but who's the main person now? It's Esther. So at any rate, the king's decree is to be proclaimed throughout all his empire, so that all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. So So this is their solution. Now, can solutions sometimes be as exceptionally harsh in order to stop a serious situation from arising? I suspect that that may be the case. And we read at the very middle of the page, page 3, the reply pleased the king. So we have a situation with Queen Vashti, whether she was right or whether she was wrong. Like I said, you may have your own opinions. You may be rooting for Queen Vashti here. I don't know. Because some women are mistreated by their husbands. But in this particular situation, whether she was right or wrong in what she did, it turned out that she was wrong because of the example. This is an incredibly difficult situation. But you remember what Paul told the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 when they were taking each other to court? Why not rather take the wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? So this could have been diffused. But both the king who worded it in such a fashion and the queen who absolutely refused to come, she could have come into the king and said, look, what you're asking me to do here, could he have changed his decree? Could she have talked him into maybe changing the decree? Come and say, look, I need to talk to you for a minute. You know, we just don't know. George?
We need to think about the characteristics of people. And I think it's obvious that this king had a pretty terrific ego, and he was not about to let her embarrass him, if you will, and so he felt he had to do something when there was really no reason probably for him to do that, because he should not probably have asked her in the first place. But he was drunk, or partially drunk, right. Evidently had been, and so all these things enter into that. When we consider that, his decree should never have happened in the first place to come here. I want to show you off.
But right. Yeah. And
people in those kinds of positions in a big party don't like to be embarrassed, whether it's a king or a peon.
Yeah. And the whole reason that I'm going through it in this manner is, do you see anything in this account that's out of the ordinary? I mean, it couldn't happen in any court, in any situation, where this kind of thing could happen. And as far as culpability is concerned, it doesn't make any difference. Is God going to deal with both these people on the judgment day and give them exactly what they deserve? So that's not involved in this at all. So there's nothing in the first chapter that would in any way impugn this book being in the Old Testament covenant. And again, this is one of the major arguments that they make. One guy I read today said, Queen Vashti was the honorable one and Esther was a sinner. And I looked at that and I thought, where in the world did he get that? Well, he got that. I'll tell you how he got it later. So, fascinating book, fascinating information. And so, we just have an account, a bare, unvarnished account of what occurred. Now, the reply pleased the king, and so letters were sent to all the king's provinces. Now, why would they be concerned about it going out to everywhere? Who was at this banquet?
Everybody.
Everybody was there. So, where's this rumor going to go?
Everywhere.
Everywhere. So, how does it need to be dealt with?
Everywhere.
The command has to go everywhere. And as it pointed out, to every people in their own language, that each man should be master in his own house and speak in the language of his own people. So this was dealt with, and the proper order was restored, but that left a vacancy, or it left a gap. And it's interesting, the first thing that is stated is in Esther 2, 1 and 2 there, at the right under a new queen is to be showed. After these things, when the wrath of the king Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Now, does it sound like maybe he was having some second thoughts now? Mm-hmm. But what can he do?
Nothing.
See, the decree can't be altered. She's never to come into his presence again. So, at that point, the king's servants say, let's find somebody else. It's kind of fascinating the way they do it. Look at verse 3 there at Esther 2, 2 through 4 at the bottom, page 3. Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the women's quarters under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian, and of the women. And let beauty preparations be given them, then let the young women who please the king be queen instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king, and he did so. So, where? Oh, I'm sorry. I guess the bell rang. Let's pick up with this next week. So, leave you on the edge of your seats here. Thanks.